at about $1.2 billion a year to fossil fuels over a three-year period, of which about two-thirds went to natural gas projects. The United States, Germany, and Italy also provided billions of dollars in funding a year to overseas fossil fuel projects before the end of 2022-2023 fiscal year, according to the report, which was published last Tuesday. Britain supplied about $600 million a year on average for development of fossil fuels overseas. Canada supplied just under $11 billion a year on average in the 2020-2022 period studied, while South Korea put forward as much as $10 billion and Japan about $7 billion. Over the same three-year period, the G20 economies put about $104 billion into clean energy developments overseas, according to the report. Claire Manique, a public finance analyst at Oil Change International, said, "While rich countries continue to drag their feet and claim they can't afford to fund a globally just energy transition, countries like Canada, South Korea, Japan, and the United States appear to have no shortage of public funds for climate-wrecking fossil fuels. We must continue to hold wealthy nations accountable for their role in funding the climate crisis and demand that they move first and fastest on a fossil fuel phase-out, to stop funding fossil fuel projects in the future, and that they pay their fair share of a globally just transition, loss and damage and adaptation finance." Makiko Arima, a senior finance campaigner at Oil Change International, called on Japan particularly to stop supporting fossil fuel projects. "Japan has lobbied behind the scenes to stop G7 countries adopting a stronger stance on fossil fuels and in favour of some key projects." Makiko Arima added, "Japan is derailing the transition to renewable energy across Asia and also in the wider global scene. Despite its G7 commitment to end fossil fuel financing, its public financial institutions, like the Japan Bank for International Cooperation, continue to support new fossil fuel projects, including the Scarborough gas field in Australia and various gas power plants in Mexico. The Japan Bank for International Cooperation is currently investing a claim that it failed to follow its social and environmental safeguards in developing the Philippines' first liquefied natural gas terminal in Batangas. Japan needs to give priority to people and the planet over their profit and shift its finances from fossil fuels into renewable energies."
Netanyahu making a mistake on Gaza, according to U.S. President Joe Biden, and Britain's Rishi Sunak calls the situation increasingly intolerable. But what now as Gazans experience Eid under genocidal assault? This is Gaza Under Attack with me, Amina Taylor, and let's get up to speed with the latest developments relating to the ongoing genocide. Global Eid celebrations have taken on a more somber tone this year. Palestinians inside Gaza have marked the period that should have seen celebrations after Ramadan, still under bombardment, many grieving martyred relatives and friends. Despite the UN Security Council voting in favour of a ceasefire, Israeli strikes on Gazans have instead intensified. Netanyahu has brushed aside global condemnation and pledged no force in the world will stop his plans to continue the offensive into Rafah, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians are seeking shelter from the IOF assault. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has held talks with his British counterpart David Cameron, where the Gazan question was front and center. Both men reiterated calls for a conditional ceasefire. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has escalated its saber-rattling against Iran, with the foreign minister saying Israel will attack the Islamic Republic directly. There's been an increase in tensions after Israel struck the Iranian consular building in the Syrian capital, Damascus, causing multiple casualties and eliciting international condemnation. Since October 2023, over 34,000 Palestinian men, women and children have been killed, with over 76,000 wounded and thousands more missing, presumed dead. With us for this edition of Gaza Under Attack in the studio, Charles Kelly, a financial podcaster and analyst. And joining us from Skype from Scotland is Mick Napier. Mick is a dedicated anti-racism campaigner and a member of the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Good of you all to join us. So, Charles, we're 187 days plus into this bombardment of Gaza. There'll be so many people, especially in history, wondering how we got to this historical low point. Your own reflections.
I think we're in a very dangerous time in history. We've got these leaders who just seem to want to take us to war. I mean, there's an old saying, when all else fails, they take you to war. And, you know, we've seen it not just in Gaza, but in Ukraine. Remember that one, Ukraine, still going on. Sudan and Yemen and
DRC, I mean, yeah. Yes.
And Biden saber-rattling against China and Taiwan, when it's really nothing to do with America. And, you know, we've got escalations in that part of the world. The AUKUS, Japan joining that now. So it's a very dangerous time, and while in the West we're going about our business, really, we're just getting on with life, you know, we're going out shopping and the stock market's doing okay, and house prices seem to be on the move again, interest rates are down, and people think everything's back to normal. And, you know, they're just going about watching movies, booking Taylor Swift tickets, and the news covers a little bit, and then it goes on to other things, but people should be aware that we're in dangerous times, and these leaders could bring us to the brink of World War III.
Mick, dangerous times. What's your assessment?
I agree with every word. This is the most dangerous time. I am more fearful today about general politics than at any time in the last half century, because all the tectonic plates are moving, and at the centre of that movement is, of course, the genocide in Gaza. I mean, in a sense, it was entirely predictable. Nobody could have predicted the detail. A day before the 7th of October, it very much looked as if people in Gaza would live and die in a big concentration zone. And their children would live and die, and their grandchildren would live and die in a big concentration zone until the Israelis found an opportunity to remove them. And then everything changed. The Palestinian resistance challenged the idea that Israel is challengeable. They inflicted a swinging military defeat upon the much vaunted Israeli military with the most high-tech equipment in the world, and changed the situation forever. And we see now the Palestinians paying a huge price. But in terms of colonialism, in terms of a colonizing and dispossessing project, and the Palestinians were always doomed to be removed at one time or another, it was difficult to see how the Palestinians could even fight back. It has been the case for a very long time that Palestinians had won the most decisive battle, and quite decisively, that is, for world public opinion, that Israel was, in terms of what people actually think by their million, a pariah state, regardless of the sustained support from our governments. When popular opinion was measured, the Israeli ambassador to Britain said there was a crisis. Various other tanks said there was a huge crisis in terms of public hostility to Israel, which could cause problems for state-to-state relations. Now, we're not there yet. Here in Scotland, the First Minister has condemned Israeli ethnic cleansing. He doesn't use the word genocide because he knows the implications of that, and has called yet again for an arms embargo, although there's no power there to enforce it. But we see up and down the country, we see a million people marching through London. It was unprecedented. We've never seen anything even half that size before. We see people shutting down Israeli arms factories, the third one of the Elbit factory several weeks ago. And we see an increase in the determination of a large number of people to move from just waiting, just demonstrating, to taking active, to taking direct action against targets. So I think that the genocide is built in to the DNA of Zionism. It's the DNA of any settler colonialism. But yes, everyone knows, everyone can see that if Israel succeeds in ethnically cleansing Gaza, then the West Bank and inside 48-67 Israel will follow. And Israel also has an appetite, perhaps, to change the regime in Jordan, war with Lebanon, and of course, the shameless attack on a diplomatic.
Indeed, and Mick, I know the Iranian question will resume, and I'll touch base on that with you after we discuss the two main protagonists here, because U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken discussed the Israeli bombardment of Gaza during the meeting he had with the British Foreign Secretary David Cameron on Tuesday. Now, the two ministers talked about efforts to reach a sustainable ceasefire and get more aid into Gaza. This meeting comes as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu escalated his pledge to invade Rafah. Let's listen in.
We, of course, discussed the situation in the Middle East and in Gaza. Israel has made important commitments to significantly increase the supply of humanitarian assistance throughout Gaza and has taken some initial actions as well to move on those commitments. We're looking at a number of critical things that need to happen in the coming days, including opening a new northern point of entry for assistance into Gaza, using Ashdod on a regular basis, maximizing the flow of assistance from Jordan, as well as putting in place a much more effective deconfliction mechanism with the humanitarian groups that are providing assistance.
Anthony Blinken there, the U.S. Secretary of State. Charles, during that same press conference, David Cameron mentioned that he will, as far as he's concerned, continue the arms sales to Israel, despite the fact that hundreds of British legal experts have written to the Prime Minister to say, you are breaking international law here and you are in danger of facilitating a genocide.
That's true. They don't seem to care about these international cases.
Pesky international.
Yes, oh, get off me. Because they're not, they've got no teeth, and so they're not worried about these cases going on. And it just seems like, again, it's this move towards war, whether it's coming from America, Britain, or some force above them, they just seem to be pushing us towards that. And of course, countries have a vested interest in selling weapons. It's a big part of their economy. But I don't know why they're not backing off. And Labour do not seem to be on the same vein. They're not talking about stopping arms, sale of arms to Israel either. And I know we're going to talk about the Germany case as well. But it just baffles me that these people... I mean, I was sitting here... the last time I was sitting there, Biden was talking about a ceasefire within days. The following week, he said there'll be a ceasefire. But I mean, all the time they're talking and chatting, and you know, people are dying every day. And I just wonder how they would feel if it was their family that were dying out there. Maybe they would feel differently. But at the moment, they seem happy to just talk and discuss this and discuss that, while every day people are dying. And Netanyahu is just... I don't know if the guy is a psychopath or what, but he's a very dangerous person, hanging on to his political career, of course.
By the skin of his teeth, yes. Some might say, Mick Napier. And the idea here that we've had regional fears about an escalation, and then we saw that provocation with the Israeli attack on the Iranian consular building in outside Damascus, Syria. Just give me your feel on that, and what is actually in this? If you were perhaps Tel Aviv, what's the motivation here?
I think the motivation is one, ethnically cleanse all of Palestine, of pretty much all Palestinians. But there's also an existential fear, as well as a great violence, at the heart of the Zionist project. I mean, 7 million or 6 million Zionist Jews are surrounded by hundreds of millions of Arabs and other Middle Eastern people who can switch on their television and see people being slaughtered because they're not Jewish. And that's burning very deeply into the psyche. In a very real sense, the Zionists, the degree of violence, the genocidal nature of it, the fact that they want to be seen, the fact that there's no great problem when Israeli soldiers film themselves committing obscene acts of torture and brutality and jeering and sneering at murder, that they've emptied the intensive care unit by everyone dying and all the neonatal units as well. All that, I think, stems from the fact that Israel knows that ultimately they don't have a great future in the region, that 7 million cannot prevail against 200-300 million indefinitely. But in order to extend the life of the Zionist project, they need to instill terror. They need to send a message that they're kind of crazy, that they are ready to drop, as they have done, more tonnage on Gaza than were dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki together. They are capable of any barbarism, and I think that stems from the DNA of the Zionist project to build an exclusively Jewish state in the middle of the Middle East as an extension of Western power into that region. So I think, given that they failed to defeat the Hamas and Islamic Jihad in a very short time, what do? They have to raise the ante. And I think the desire for a regional war is not shared by Blinken and Biden at the moment, but I think it would get Netanyahu and the Zionist elite out of the pickle that they've got themselves into, because they haven't won in Gaza in the simple sense that for a military army like Israel's to win, they have to crush and defeat the enemy. For irregular forces like the Palestinian resistance to win, they merely have to survive. That's the lesson of all anti-colonial struggles. And I think we are seeing Israel failing to win, as they failed in 2006. And I think why Biden and Blinken are angry is Israel has failed. And that's the only crime that Washington actually acknowledges, when they failed to terrorize the region effectively. But it's very dangerous, because they will now up the ante,
with more lives obviously hanging in the balance there. Well, the holy month of Ramadan was supposed to bring a ceasefire in Gaza, but Israel actually escalated the offensive and has also gone on a killing rampage on Eid, normally a joyous time to celebrate the end of the holy month. Now, we asked the pro-Palestinian activist in London, Zebunisa Rao, why she thinks that ceasefire didn't hold.
Israel does not want to. It has the ironclad support of the loudest governments in the West. It has laid out plans and will not stop until its aims are complete, unless it is stopped. The UNSC resolution for Ramadan was passed on 25th of March, 15 days into Ramadan. The US abstained, while John Kirby, the White House National Security spokesperson, told reporters, "Our vote does not, and I repeat that, does not represent a shift in our policy." Biden signed off on $4 billion more in weapons for Israel to further the genocide. On the following day, March the 26th, the US passed a bill where it mentioned that it will limit funding to the West Bank and Gaza if the Palestinian Authority abstains UN statehood, or if it allows or supports any war crime investigation against Israel at the ICC. Israel has a blatant disregard for authority of any kind, even for the hand that feeds it. According to Article 25 UN Charter, ratified by the US, all UNSC resolutions are binding and not optional. In December 2016, UNSC passed a resolution deeming Israel's settlements in Palestine to be illegal and a violation of international law. Israel ignored this resolution. In December 2023, the UN General Assembly voted with an overwhelming majority to call for a humanitarian ceasefire. Israel refused to act on it. Israel Knesset member Balmog Cohen said during Ramadan, "Now is the best time to kill them." Israeli Heritage Minister Amichai Eliyahu said the so-called month of Ramadan must be wiped out, and our fear of this month must also be wiped out. Leaflets were dropped into the West Bank wishing a happy Ramadan and warning against even thinking against Israel or taking part in protests. Israel has stated repeatedly that it would not comply with any orders, and that it will escalate in Ramadan. And this is unsurprising.
Zebenisa also said the UN can bring the genocide in Gaza to an end if it wanted to.
Israel has historically defied orders of the highest authority time and time again. What else do we expect it to do in the future? The next step after Israel defies a binding resolution would be to suspend it from the UN, and when it continues defying it, for it to be expelled. I'm sure they won't bat an eyelid. The US and the UK are ready to wage war at the drop of a hat anywhere in the world. The UK nation was asked to bravely tighten our belts as we weaponized Ukraine against Russia, and now Israel. So why have these governments not helped arm the people of Gaza? Why are world leaders afraid to unite in a simple military defensive stance for a nation of people who are unarmed, unprotected, and experiencing a slow and gradual physical decimation in the face of total annihilation? Although the UN appears sloth-like, yet similar to a sloth, it does have teeth and claws. In 1948, the UN Security Council authorized the deployment of UN military observers to monitor the armistice agreement between Israel and its Arab neighbors. Many options can be availed for military presence, but the fastest option is immediate Air Force contingents. According to the UN Charter, action with respect to threats to the peace, breaches of the peace, and acts of aggression, Article 45, states, in order to enable the UN to take urgent military measures, members shall hold immediately available national Air Force contingents for combined international enforcement action. But the complication is that the P5 member states, US, Great Britain, Russia, China, and France, must come to a collective will for these actions to happen.
Eid is a more somber affair in Gaza this year as Palestinians continue to live under occupation and the specter of genocide. After morning prayers, Muslims often visit the graves of deceased loved ones during a three-day festival that marks the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. A Gazan imam shares why nothing is as usual this time around.
This Eid is completely different from previous Eids in the Gaza Strip. This Eid is full of sacrifices, pain, wounds, the blood of martyrs, the bombing of homes, and the terrorization of safe people. However, we are in the Gaza Strip despite these massacres, these pains, and a large number of martyrs, and most recently last night in the Nusayrat camp. We honor God's rituals on this great and blessed day, and we rejoice and make our children happy on this day.
Just time enough for the final thoughts of Charles Kelly and Mick Napier on the few moments we have left on this show. And before we went to that series there, Charles, we talked about the perhaps perceived toothlessness of the United Nations. At the moment, there's currently a case that's been brought by Nicaragua along the same lines as the South African case, this time against Germany for what Nicaragua is arguing is facilitating the genocide by continuing to sell arms to Israel. Give me your thoughts on that. Will it go anyway differently to the ICJ case with South Africa that's currently being considered?
I think it's helpful in the sense that it brings attention to countries like Germany, and it's educational, but I can't see it going that far. I mean, there was a barrister talking about just things like, you know, it's ironic that Germany is dropping aid by planes into Gaza while at the same time supplying arms that is causing the problem. And it's a terrible situation. The people of Gaza, I saw footage of them celebrating Eid, and you've got to admire their faith to go out and still try and carry on with some sort of normality. But meanwhile, it's a very dark situation for them, and with, you know, Netanyahu promising to go into Rafah. I mean, why this guy is prime minister, I just don't know. His comeback from fraud charges to becoming prime minister again is on a par with the comeback of Lazarus, isn't it? Because what is he, the comeback kid or something? How he can be in power? And now, of course, he needs the war to stay in power. And it's a horrendous situation for the rest of the world, as well as Gaza.
Well, some people are hoping he'll be the Hague kid after this. Mick Napier, the idea here that, as I mentioned in the introduction, Netanyahu says no force in the world will stop this Rafah offensive. It's nonsensical, isn't it?
It's based on his always being able to publicly defy condemnation from the EU, from the UN, but condemnations that rested all at words. And he doesn't care if the whole world recognizes that he's a criminal, and the whole Zionist elite has long been committed to ethnic cleansing and full-spectrum criminality, as long as there are no effective sanctions. They only respond to force. The problem with the UN is, of course, it's designed in such a way that America and Britain and others can paralyze any action against their interests. I mean, I would like to carry water in a bucket, but if there's a big hole in it, then it's not much use as a bucket. And the UN suffers from a structural weakness of the same kind. We are now at a situation where governments are embarrassed by Israel, but they continue to send bombs together with the criticism. They continue to send bombs and ask for a kinder, gentler genocide. But around the world, Europe is fantastically isolated. We see the Houthis in Yemen coming to the aid of the people of Gaza facing genocide, acting on international law, acting to do everything within their power to end that genocide, and being bombed by Britain and America. But here's the question. Why didn't the US carpet bomb Yemen as they carpet bombed Vietnam with B-52s? They could wipe out everybody. Because they're afraid. They realize that they're in a situation where if they inflame popular opinion throughout the region sufficiently, then they will be defeated. And I think that the resistance across the region, Yemen, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, everywhere, that's the key to victory. And that, backed up by an increasingly angry world public opinion, which can force a political price on our rulers, that's the key to victory. Otherwise, Israel will ultimately generate a huge regional war which will have cataclysmic suffering for all of us. It was built into the very DNA of the Zionist project to displace millions of local people to make way for European Zionists.
Indeed, and Charles, last thoughts to you here. We're seeing these weekly demonstrations, one coming up in London at the end of this week. Are they working? Are they changing hearts and minds? Less than a minute.
I think gradually they are. And Mick mentioned Zionism, and of course, Zionists are not confined to just Jewish people only. The culture of Zionism is embedded into the US culture, the education system, our culture, our Judeo-Christian culture, and Zionism is embedded into that. And, you know, it is starting to change the hearts and mind. And Mick also mentioned about the Arab nations. Of course, they're not united, are they? And they've got their own interests and their own leagues with the West and their own economic interest. And you could say that some of them just don't care about the Palestinians at all. So there's not a united front against Israel. And indeed, the Arab nations do business with Israel as well. So that, I think that's why Israel can survive. But definitely that Israel is the main cause of instability in that region. And they're bringing us to the brink of world war with their actions, these crazy actions by psychopathic leaders.
Indeed, what a place to leave things on. And that does it for us. Charles Kelly and Mick Napier were our very special guests. And of course, our thanks to them and to you for being with us. Until next time, continue to keep Palestine in your heart.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The Limelight.
The head of UNICEF, Catherine Russell, has talked about a staggering rate of child deaths in Gaza, not seen in any conflict in the world. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The French national broadcaster France 24, France 24, has covered this story and tells us more. In an interview with France 24, Catherine Russell, the executive director of the United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, sounded the alarm about the plight of children in Gaza after more than 5 months of Israel's brutal war. The head of UNICEF said an estimate of 13,450 children killed in the Palestinian territories since 7th of October last year is probably on the low side. She noted that many more children are trapped in the rubble or are wounded and often separated from their families. Catherine Russell also discussed the incredibly dire situation regarding hunger in Gaza. According to a United Nations-backed food security assessment, half of Gaza's population is experiencing catastrophic hunger, with famine projected to hit northern Gaza any time between now and May without urgent intervention. This is very much a man-made problem, Russell told France 24. All of us in the international community have to do better here and make sure that we can get aid to these children in Gaza. She added, "We cannot have children starving to death in Gaza. That is not acceptable." Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story. The staggering rate of child deaths in Gaza has not been seen in any other conflict in the world, according to UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell, speaking on Sunday, 17th of March. "I think these numbers that we're seeing out of Gaza are just staggering. We haven't seen that rate of death among children in almost any other conflict in the world. It's really shocking," Catherine Russell said during a television program. "More than 13,000 children have been killed, thousands of others injured, trapped under rubble or have lost their parents, Russell said, adding, it's a horrifying situation. Catherine Russell added that the profound impact on children in Gaza stemming from the stress, grief, loss and fear they experience is bound to have lasting effects on them and potentially on their own offspring as well. We know now that children are dying from malnutrition in Gaza, she said. I've seen a lot of children, unfortunately, in my job around the world who suffer from malnutrition. It's a shocking thing to see. Essentially, the body starts to consume itself because it has nothing else, and it's a painful, painful death for children. She added that even if therapeutic feeding can be provided to those in need, they often endure lifelong consequences, such as stunted growth, which also affects their cognitive abilities. It's a lifelong challenge for these children if they survive, she said. Israel has waged a deadly military offensive on Gaza since 7th of October last year. More than 31,600 Palestinians, many of them women and children, have been killed in the enclave and nearly 73,700 others have been injured amid mass destruction and shortage of basic necessities. The Israeli war on Gaza has pushed 85% of Gaza's population into internal displacement amid a crippling blockade of food, clean water and medicine. Iran's Press TV has also covered the same story. UNICEF Regional Director for West Asia and North Africa has warned that more children in Gaza will die due to impending famine as the Israeli regime continues to impede aid operations in Gaza. Adel Khodr urged Israel to open all border crossings to allow aid into Gaza Strip, citing the Integrated Food Security Phase classification, recent report warning of an imminent famine in Gaza. The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification or IPC findings on Gaza confirm what we have been warning about of impending famine for months now. The world's inaction is shocking as more children succumb to a slow death. All border crossings must open now to allow unfettered access to humanitarian aid for the population of Gaza, Adel Khodr wrote on social media post. The IPC, a group that includes the World Food Programme and the World Health Organization, warned that famine is imminent in northern Gaza Strip, with people suffering catastrophic levels of hunger. It said 1.1 million people, half of Gaza's population, are experiencing catastrophic food insecurity. According to the IPC, the Integrated Food Security Phase classification, virtually all households are skipping meals every day and adults are reducing their meals so that children can eat. In 2/3 of households in northern Gaza, the report said people went entire days and nights without eating at least 10 times in the last 30 days. In southern Gaza Strip, this applies to 1/3 of the households. In a statement published on Monday, the United States Agency for International Development USAID Administrator Samantha Power said the IPC report is a reality for the population of Gaza. Samantha Power added that there have been only two famine declarations in the 21st century, which marks a truly tragic milestone. The catastrophic levels of hunger and malnutrition described in the IPC report should be unimaginable in the current era. But for hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza, this is reality, Samantha Power said. Martin Griffiths, the United Nations top relief coordinator, said on X that the international community should hang its head in shame for failing to stop the famine in Gaza. We know that once a famine is declared, it is way too late. The head of UNRWA, the United Nations Reliefs and Works Agency Philip Lazzarini also expressed his disappointment as he was refused entry into Gaza, where he was scheduled to enhance the humanitarian response in the territory. "This man-made starvation under our watch is a stain on our collective humanity," Philip Lazzarini wrote on a post on X. Meanwhile, the president of Iran said Ebrahim Raisi has called for a serious practical step to stop the Israeli regime's ongoing attacks on war-torn Gaza. The Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, was speaking during his New Year message to Asian countries celebrating Nowruz, the Iranian New Year. The Iranian president said Nowruz is a message of peace and peaceful coexistence and also a symbol of reconciliation. The Iranian president said this year, "We, the countries of the Nowruz Civilization Zone, are celebrating this auspicious occasion while the oppressed and powerful people of Gaza are facing the brutal attacks of the usurper Zionist regime and are also under a complete siege, being deprived of their access to basic healthcare and basic facilities and are in danger of starvation and famine." The Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, said, "It is our humanitarian duty to use our capabilities to take serious practical steps to stop the attacks of the Zionist regime and send humanitarian aid to the oppressed people of Gaza." The Iranian president sent a message addressed to the leaders and peoples of the countries of the Nowruz Civilization Zone. In a separate New Year message addressed to the Iranian people, President Raisi hailed Gaza's resolute resistance against the brutal Israeli onslaught. He said the global powers use all their might to try to destroy the 2 million people of Gaza. Meanwhile, the Islamic resistance in Iraq has said its fighters have attacked Ben Gurion Airport twice in the past week using drones. In a statement on Wednesday, 20th of March, the Iraqi resistance confirmed its attack on the Israeli regime, which is currently waging a genocidal war on the people of Gaza. The fighters of the Islamic resistance in Iraq at dawn on Tuesday have targeted Ben Gurion Airport in the Zionist regime using drones. The resistance also affirmed its commitment to strike the enemy's stronghold as part of its second phase of operations in support of the Palestinians of Gaza. In response to the Israeli massacre of Palestinian civilians, the second phase of the resistance's operations has started, which include the enforcement of a blockade on Israeli maritime navigation in the Mediterranean Sea and putting Israeli ports out of service. The resistance also attacked the same airport on 12th of March using drones. The Islamic resistance in Iraq says it will continue its attacks on Israeli targets until Israel stops its genocidal war in Gaza.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
People across Africa marked the International Coast Day with massive rallies to demonstrate solidarity with the oppressed people of Palestine while condemning the Israeli apartheid regime over its atrocities and occupation of Palestine. Record numbers turned out at this year's rallies because the world has been awoken by the horrific genocidal crimes being perpetrated against Palestinians by the Israeli apartheid regime in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. South Africa's case at the International Court of Justice over the Israeli apartheid regime's genocidal war on Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip has galvanized African support for Palestine. The large turnout at this year's Quds Day rallies across Africa once again reaffirmed the continent's historical support for the liberation of Palestine. Now, elsewhere in Africa, Senegal witnessed a historical presidential election in which Bassirou Diomaye Faye won by a landslide, thus becoming Senegal's youngest president. So, what will be the future of Senegal under the new leadership? Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and this is Africa Today. This week, we're focusing on International Coup Day rallies in Africa that demonstrated Africa's unflinching solidarity with oppressed Palestinians and condemnation of the Israeli apartheid regime and its crimes. Now, the second segment of our program will be on the recent presidential election in Senegal. So, stay tuned with us.
God's Day in Africa. The last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan marks International Quds Day, a day dedicated to showing solidarity with the Palestinian people and their struggle against Israeli occupation. This annual event was first initiated by the late Imam Khomeini, founder of the Islamic Republic, in 1979 as a way to raise awareness about the plight of Palestinians and to call for the liberation of Quds.
Since then, events marking Quds Day have been held in African countries. Now, this year, the masses in Africa, angered by the U.S.-Israeli genocide on Palestinians in Gaza, turned out in large numbers at various events marking the International Quds Day. Here are some of the images.
Free, free Palestine!
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 1, 2, 3, 4.
Now, to discuss this year's Quds Day rallies in Africa, we have contacted Dr. Vahida Qasim. She's the daughter of the late Imam Ahmed Qasim, the founder and leader of the Qibla movement in South Africa. Dr. Qasim is a member of the leadership committee of this movement. Thanks a lot for your time, madam, today.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Brother Mubarak, shukran for having me.
Now, our first question to Dr. Qasim. Tell us the significance of the International Quds Day in Africa this year, particularly considering the ongoing U.S.-Israeli genocide on Palestinians in Gaza.
The International Quds Day, the call for solidarity with and in support of the oppressed masses the world over, especially that of the Palestinian people, has always been of significance to the justice and freedom-loving people of Africa. The Qibla movement, since its establishment in 1980, has since then, and shortly after the call by Imam Khomeini, may Allah be pleased with him, the call which was for the solidarity of the masses with the oppressed people, has been hosting the Quds Day March in Cape Town, and that is for approximately now 42 years. This year, however, it is more significant because of the heinous, calculated massacring of our Palestinian brethren and the fact that the South African government has taken this matter to the ICJ, the International Court of Justice.
African people have brutally experienced firsthand mankind's disregard for human life during the evil transatlantic slave trade and later when colonial powers ruled with an iron fist over the continent. With such a historical background, African people can relate with suffering of Palestinian people.
The liberation of all oppressed people is and will be important for the people of Africa. Africa itself being a colonized continent has been actively shedding its colonizers' hold. The colonizers are using the resources of Africa to fund the genocide in occupied Palestine. We have an example of three of our African countries, namely Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso, who have recently liberated themselves from the French neocolonial stronghold. So the liberation of Palestine is therefore of utmost importance to Africa.
The Quds Day rallies across the world convey various messages, chief among them being hatred towards the genocidal Zionist regime, as well as support for the oppressed nation of Palestine.
If you remember very well, the Palestinians, when we were under apartheid, they said, let us liberate the South Africans. Later, when South Africans are liberated, they will come and liberate us. So what I'm saying is that there was an international pressure. There were organizations such as this which placed the pressure upon the oppressors who oppressed us at the time.
This is a man-made situation, so it's a humanitarian issue. However, it's been man-made by Israel. All they need to do is open up the borders and then people can start eating and living again.
And now my next question to Dr. Wahid Kassim. Now, what was the main message of the International Quds Day in Africa this year?
In South Africa, we have a saying. We say, neither oppressor nor oppressed be. By this, we mean that the days of the oppressors have been numbered. And by the same token, the oppressed masses are craving their liberation, as I'm sure the Palestinian people are too. The oppressor, we say, will not dictate to the oppressed on how to respond to their oppression, nor will the oppressor dictate the terms of engagement.
Now, African states are emerging today as strong supporters of the Palestinian cause, and the South African case against the Israeli regime at the ICJ is a case in point.
We have seen how the current genocidal war against Palestinians has isolated the Zionist regime in Africa. And this year's Quds Day rallies have left no doubt that African masses are with the oppressed Palestinians. Many in Africa are now demanding that their governments take a more affirmative position in favor of Palestinians.
We would want all other African countries also to liberate themselves, as was done by our three African countries, namely Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali. And the same direction is now being taken by Senegal. It is the responsibility of the citizens to apply pressure on their governments, their respective governments, who are to serve the interests of their citizens and not their puppeteers, to ensure that they will follow through on these demands.
The apartheid regime in South Africa was ousted partly due to the successful international boycott movement. Some African countries, particularly South Africa, are implementing initiatives to boycott this brutal Israeli apartheid regime, particularly during the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Now, my next question to Dr. Wahid Kassim. How successful is the current movement to boycott the Israeli regime, and what should be done to actually strengthen it?
A common slogan that is chanted by our South African people is a slogan that goes as follows. Brick by brick, wall by wall, the Zionist state will fall. This means to us that by any means necessary, utilizing all forms of resistance, including the boycotting campaign, that we will continue to chip away at the Zionist state's existence. We must intensify all our efforts of resistance to ensure the liberation of the Palestinian people, but also of the oppressed people the world over.
Nelson Mandela famously said that our freedom is incomplete without the freedom of the Palestinians. The International Quds Day is always a great reminder of Mandela's resolve to back the liberation of Palestine.
And now my last question. Dr. Kassim, what needs to be done by the people of Africa to ensure that Nelson Mandela's aspiration for a free Palestine is eventually attained?
The unity of the African masses is of paramount importance, as according to Hadith, which states that the Ummah is like a body. And if one part of the body is afflicted, the rest of the body will feel or respond to that affliction. So yes, unless all the oppressed people are liberated, will we ourselves not be free? Because until then, we have the obligation and the responsibility to support and engage in the oppressed people's fight for liberation. I do want to add that the Qibla movement has always maintained the following principle, that we are non-violent to non-violent people only. When others resort to violence, they make nonsense of our non-violence. And unless our legitimate right to the freedom of expression and association and self-determination is protected by the legitimate right to self-defense and resistance, then all of our other rights are going to be violated and rendered useless and impotent. So first, we call for the unification of all the African countries and its people, so that we can secure the liberation of all the oppressed people in Africa, as well as those across the world.
Well, unfortunately, our time is over for now. I would like to thank Dr. Wahida Qasim for her insight on the International Coups Day in Africa. We now take a short break before our next topic on the recent presidential election in Senegal. Stay with us.
Victory for Senegalese democracy.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Bassirou Diomaye Faye, a Pan-Africanist, has been sworn in as Senegal's youngest president, pledging systematic change, greater sovereignty, and calm after years of deadly turmoil.
Senegal's youngest president, Faye, defeated the ruling coalition's candidate in a March election by a landslide, reflecting high hopes for change in the country of around 18 million.
Addressing the Senegalese nation after his victory, Faye, a popular politician among disaffected youth, promised to govern with humility and transparency.
The Senegalese people have chosen to break with the past, to give substance to the immense hopes raised by our vision of society. I hope that our vision of society has given substance to their aspirations. I pledge to govern with humility and transparency, and to fight corruption at all levels.
Well, for more on Senegal's historic presidential election, we have contacted Galissa Bouly, Secretary General of the African Patriots of Senegal for Work, Ethics and Fraternity branch in the West Coast of the U.S. This is the political party of the newly elected President Diomaye Faye and Prime Minister Ousmane Sonko. Thank you for your time, sir, today.
It's a pleasure being with you, Mubarak.
Now, Faye won more than 54% of the votes cast in Senegal's delayed presidential election. He was released from prison 10 days before the election, and therefore he did not have even ample time to campaign. Now, first question. Briefly, can you tell us what are the main factors behind this historic and significant victory of Mr. Faye?
It's because the Senegalese people, for the last 12 years, have been betrayed by Macky Sall leadership. But also, from independence to now, the Senegalese people are trying to find a leader that will lead this country in the benefit of the population of this country. So I think this victory is a victory of the people, is a victory of freedom, but it's a victory of democracy. It's a victory of Senegalese people deciding for the first time to have a leader that would represent their interests.
Over the past few years, we have seen several protests against France in Senegal. Many young people regarded Macky Sall as a symbol of French capitalism. Ousmane Sonko, who is now the Prime Minister of Senegal, won mass support by attacking French imperialism's stranglehold on the nation. He was imprisoned by Sall and even barred from running in the presidential election. There are strong indicators that France is in the suppression and imprisonment of Faye and Sonko.
All I know is that Mr. Sonko and Mr. Jamai Faye are two Senegalese people that know very well who is investing in Senegal.